From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Alan Toussaint. He's been a longtime figure on the New Orleans rhythm and blues scene as a pianist, arranger, producer, and the author of several hit songs, including Working in a Coal Mine and Mother-in-Law. Also today, I talk with psychotherapists Susie Orbach and Louise Eichenbaum. Their new book is a feminist analysis of how the pressures of family and career have injected new feelings of competition and jealousy into friendships between women. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new album by flutist Fenwick Smith, and Jan Harald Brunvand debunks another urban legend, this one about the poisonous poinsettia. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. A lot of the rhythms of early rock and roll came out of New Orleans. Since the late 50s, my guest Alan Toussaint has been one of the most important behind-the-scenes figures in the New Orleans sound. At the beginning of his career, he was the chief songwriter, producer, arranger, and pianist for Minute Records, which was the most important New Orleans record company of the period. He wrote and produced regional hits for Aaron Neville, Irma Thomas, and Benny Spillman. Toussaint's songs Mother-in-Law and Working in a Coal Mine became national hits. Since the late 60s, Toussaint has run a New Orleans recording studio with his partner Marshall Seahorn, where they've recorded many internationally known performers, including Paul McCartney and New Edition. Toussaint also produced Dr. John's hit Right Place, Wrong Time, wrote Yes We Can, which became the Pointer Sisters' first big hit, and wrote Sneak and Sally Through the Alley, which was a hit for Robert Palmer. Alan Toussaint told me that he made his recording debut back in 1957, playing the piano in the style of Fats Domino for one of Domino's own recordings, this one, I Want You to Know.
I want you to know I love her so well, and I love her so much, I could never, never tell, oh boy.
That was a popular during that time to play like other people. I hadn't established who I really was yet, so if they wanted someone who would play like others, like Ray Charles or Fats Domino, they could very well call me and know they would get what they were looking for. We were up to two tracks at that time, a multi-two-track recording, and Fats Domino was out of the country, and Dave Bartholomew, who was his producer and writer on many songs, called me in to play like him, like Fats Domino would play on a song called I Want You to Know, and one another called Something About a Little Schoolgirl. And I went in and played, and that was sort of a milestone in my early getting started.
So you had to play exactly in his style. You already had his style down from listening to records?
By all means, yes. Yeah. Everything. Mistakes and all.
When you filled in for Fats Domino, was that supposed to be a big secret? Were you supposed to not tell anyone that that was actually you playing on his record?
Oh, no. That was never mentioned. But no one really got to know that in the public generally, because that kind of information isn't usually publicized. But it never was hush-hush among the musical community. The guys around knew, and it was kind of fun.
You also, early in your career, toured with Shirley and Lee, who did Let the Good Times Roll.
Yes.
Now, what was it like to be a teenager on the road with a band like that?
It was utterly wonderful. It was quite a learning experience, and to play with a band all of the time, just about nightly, was good for me because I wrote lots of arrangements, and I got a lot of my transposition and chords ironed out. So it was quite a learning experience. And then to travel and to get around different places, especially in station wagons as we traveled at that time, you could really see America.
How old were you then?
I was 18 when I first started with them.
So you were of drinking age. You were allowed to drink in the places that you played if you were playing in a club.
Oh, yes, but I didn't have much time for drinking. I had to stay sane at that time. I had to take a look at America.
Now, in 1959, when you were around 21, Minute Records opened, which became one of the most important of the New Orleans record companies. And you were the house arranger, pianist, and composer. That company was really known for creating a New Orleans sound. What do you associate with that New Orleans sound? What kind of rhythms do you think of? What kind of arrangement?
I think, in short, syncopation. The kind of syncopation that was inspired by the street bands. By street bands, I mean the second line bands that were early originated for funerals. In fact, it goes back longer than any of us can remember. But the syncopation, the horn licks that sort of associate with that kind of band. And I think that was largely responsible for how the New Orleans beat turned out to be for that period.
Now, what did you listen to growing up that made that such a natural sound for you?
Professor Longhair, foremost for his New Orleans people. Fats Domino, of course. And I listened to everyone, however. As a young child, I thought that all pianists played everything. I mean, I thought anything on piano, any piano music, all pianists played it. So I tried a little Bach, a little Professor Longhair, a little Alfred Ammons, Boogie Woogie, some Strauss waltzes, some Liberace. I really came into my senses later to find out that you can't really do it all. But as an early child, I tried to play every kind of music that I heard. I thought everyone was doing that.
And then you learned they weren't.
Oh, yes, and I learned I weren't.
One of the first national hits that you had, a hit that you, a song you wrote and produced and arranged, was Mother-in-Law, the Ernie K. Doe record. This is back in 1961. I want to play some of that record, but tell us the story behind how you wrote it.
Well, I wrote that along with four other songs that day. During that period, all of the artists would gather in the front room of my parents' home, and I would write one song for one artist. We'd all sing it, and then I'd write another one, another for another, and we'd all sing that one, and the first artist would sing background behind the other. That's how sometime Ernie Cato would sing background for Aaron Neville. Aaron would sing background for Irma. But Mother-in-Law was written the same day as Tainted the Truth, won a $10,000 reward, and Hello, My Lover. And we had a great time with it. When I first wrote it, when Ernie Cato first attempted to sing it in the front room, it didn't come off nearly the way I thought it should have in my mind. So I wanted to discard that song like I had done so many others. And Ernie Cato took it out of the trash can as I was writing a song for someone else and say, man, let's give this another try. And we did, and I'm so glad that he did.
Yeah, this is really a very big hit. Let's listen to it. This is back from 1961, Ernie K. Doe singing Alan Toussaint's song, Mother-in-Law.
Mother-in-law,
mother-in-law. Try to put me out. How could she stoop so low?
That was you playing piano there, right?
Yes.
Did a lot of people play back that solo to you through the years?
You mean on piano?
Yeah. I always remember what the solos were on Rock and Roll Records.
Oh, thank you. Oh, nice. Oh, no, I never noticed any other bands playing it enough to know whether they played the solo or not.
Right. I'm listening to that record, I think of how much recording technology has changed over the years.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Now, that was one of the first national hits that you had. You had had regional hits before that, right?
Right, right. But that was the first one that really made the mark. However, Java was written before that, but it didn't prove itself until after that.
Now, how did that one, how did Mother-in-Law break out?
Incidentally, that was Benny Spellman singing the low voice on that, the Mother-in-Law section.
Oh, really?
Yes. And another artist by the name of Calvin LeBlanc and Willie Harper sing in the background. Mother-in-Law was done at the same day, like I say, of Hello My Love and Tainted the Truth, which was the first recordings to come out on that session that we thought was the better songs. And, of course, they sold every bit of 150 records, maybe. And Mother-in-Law really came out and showed us what we should be doing at that time.
I think back in the early 60s, there was still a lot of payola around. And especially for a small regional company, there was pressure, I think, on some of them to pay their way into radio play. Was that ever a problem for you to get airplay without participating in the corruption of the record and radio industries?
I'm sorry to seem naive, but I really don't know, because I was so involved in the music and daily writing and singing with the artists every day, all day long. I think the two gentlemen that owned the company, Larry McKinley and Joe Banaschak, really kept me away from that. I never got to know that. I would hear about it from a very long distance, that there was things going on. There were things going on like that. But I was always busy writing and having a great time.
I want to ask you about another song that you wrote, another one that was a hit. And this is Working in a Coal Mine, which Lee Dorsey was the first to record. Another song you wrote, arranged, produced. What's the story behind this song?
Well, Lee Dorsey has inspired many, many wonderful songs, as far as I'm concerned. And I only can afford to call them wonderful, because I know they are more part of him than they are of me, even though I wrote the entire songs. Lee Dorsey would inspire songs that just wouldn't come from any other source, like Took a Little Trip to Mexico. There's no reason for that. I didn't take a little trip to Mexico or anything like that at that time. But Working in a Coal Mine was one that we liked when we went in to do it, but it didn't really come together in the studio as it should. And Marshall Seahorn took and put a razor to the tape, which is a term for splicing the tape, and put the first part on the end and made it a complete recording, which was good for all of us, because we did like the final product. But as far as Working in the Coal Mine, lots of folk ask me, how was it inspired? Do I know anything about coal mines? Not at all. Nothing more than what I've seen in the movies.
So why did you write about coal mines?
I don't know.
It just came to you.
That's Lee Dorsey again. When he's around and I hear his voice in my head, things come.
Well, let's hear this recording, Working in a Coal Mine, written and produced by my guest, Alan Toussaint.
Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, about to slip down.
5 o'clock in the morning, I'm already up and gone. Lord, I'm so tired. If this goes on,
better working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
Working
in a coal mine,
going
down, down, down.
Working
in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
Close I make a little money, hauling coal by the ton. But when Saturday
That's Working in a Coal Mine, performed by the late Lee Dorsey, written and produced by my guest Alan Toussaint. Well, I want to talk with you more about songs that you've written, produced, and also sung. We'll talk about your own performing a little bit later, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Alan Toussaint. We'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Alan Toussaint is my guest. As your record started to really take off and become popular around the country, did performers start leaving New Orleans for New York or Los Angeles or other centers of the record industry?
The performers that were recording the songs that I was writing?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't leave and move away as they began to do much later on. During that period, they usually stayed. Some travel who had national hits like Ernie Cato and Lee Dorsey, of course, but they didn't move away, not at that time.
Now, a few years after Minute disbanded, you set up your own studio, and then you formed a studio with Marshall Seahorn, who you collaborated with for a long time.
Right.
And that was probably one of the biggest studios in New Orleans?
Oh, yes, yes, C. Saint Recording Studio. It's still there.
And you were the first to have, I think, 24-track recording.
Oh, yes, yes, by all means.
So did other record companies from different parts of the country start shipping their artists to you to get the New Orleans sound?
Yes. We entertained lots of artists from England. Badger, in fact, was the first group that recorded in our studio. We always remember Badger because we rolled our first Ampex tape on Badger. And Jeff Roden afterwards was Frankie Miller, of course, LaBelle, Joe Cocker, lots of folk. Eric Gale, Ramsey Lewis.
Now, I know Paul McCartney has produced stuff at your studio. Did you learn anything unusual from watching him work? I don't know if your styles are very different. I imagine they are.
Yes, I noticed that he was very much a perfectionist, and he knew where the magic was before he got there. He knew where he was going, and he knew exactly when he had arrived as a producer. You go for the feeling, and of course for things to be correct, which is one little factor that we almost like to take for granted, that it can be correct. But when, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
But when it's feeling good is the most important thing, and when there's no ragged edges. And Paul McCartney knew how to go exactly for that, and he got exactly what he wanted to, exactly. He knew when he had arrived, and everyone knew it. And it was good, very good. And I hear it in all of his recordings.
The group that basically became your rhythm section was the Meters, and then you also produced hits for them. And they were the Meters basically was the Neville brothers, and you had been working with singer Aaron Neville for years, I mean, since close to the beginning of your career, right?
Well, something like that, yes. Of course, the last part, working with Aaron for many, many years, yes. When I first began writing for recordings, Aaron was there, yes. And Art Neville's I recorded as a single artist also. When I first saw the Meters, they were going by the name of the Neville Sounds, which was only one Neville in them. It was Art Neville's. It so happens he was the leader of the band. And the Meters was one band that he had put together, like many others. And I must say that he's a natural leader, because every time he's ever put a band together, it's been very special and very unique. And the Meters was no exception, of course.
What was it about their sound that attracted you, that you wanted to use in your records?
Total syncopation, popping everywhere. Every musician in the Meters, it was only four of them, but they all were playing percussion on their instruments. The guitarist was playing percussion, the bass player was playing percussion, and of course, organ Art Nevels was on the organ. Very percussive group, and Zig on drums was just outrageously wonderful.
You've written some songs under the name of Naomi Neville.
Right.
Are you any relation to the Neville brothers?
We don't know. Naomi Neville is my mother's maiden name. And I used that for some good business reasons, I thought, earlier. I was underage when I was with a company. And when I became of age, I was about to change companies. And until that was ironed out in the courts, I used a pseudonym, which was my mother's maiden name. I just wanted to keep a name that was in the house in case the computer made a mistake. At least it would come to the same house.
So you may or may not be related to the Nevilles. You don't really know. That's interesting.
Right. Art and I usually wonder about that.
Right.
Yes. Small world.
You've produced many hits for a lot of groups and solo artists, but I don't think any of your own records have ever made it on the charts, have they?
No, not at all.
How do you feel about that? Do you wish that you were better known as a performer in addition to as a composer and producer?
Not really, because I know that I haven't worked at that as I worked at everything else that I do or have done. And I think things have a way of seeking their levels. I've been a writer and producer, and it's been dear to my heart, and I've dearly given myself to it, so I think it's all fair.
Well, I want to play a record of you performing. This is from the early 70s, and this is you performing your own song, From a Whisper to a Scream. Do you want to say anything about it before we hear it?
Well, I haven't heard it since the day we recorded it, to be perfectly frank. I did that out in L.A. With Charlie Green. It was a wonderful time. I think that's on a Tiffany label, a subsidiary of Warn. And it was the first experience of me going away from home and put myself in someone's hands to say when to go and do this and where. And I thought it was really great, really fine.
Well, I guess this is going to take you back over 25 years. I think it's a really good record. Let's listen to it.
From a whisper in the wind,
whisper,
to a loud scream,
hey!
The message came that I've lost you, to the warmth of another man. For heaven's sake, girl, don't do this to me. I've seen more tears fall from your eyes than all the showers of April. I took kindness for granted as if it came with the wallpaper. So inconsiderate of how much you care. For some stupid reason, I just thought you had to be there. But oh, my love, you've lost. Oh, my love.
Well, what do you think? It's been a long time since you've heard that.
Yes, I don't know what to think of that. It's certainly a concoction of something there. I just don't know what to think. I remember it now very well. But during that period, I was very busy, and after that, I just moved on. I got out of Dodge.
I know you've been in and out of the studio recording stuff of your own for the past couple of years, yet you haven't released anything yet. Are you more cautious about your own stuff than other people's? Are you more reluctant to actually put it out?
Well, yes. When it comes to myself as an artist, it's confusing to me. With others, I know generally where they are, or at least my impression of them. Like LaBelle comes in with the full energy. I know where that's at, and it's exciting, and I could see the effervescence flying everywhere. And Joe Cocker, I could see exactly where he is and what I loved about him. But myself, when it's time to put on the hat as an artist, I don't know where to start. And I find that that has been a problem for me throughout many albums that I've done. So in the last couple of years, I haven't been signed with anyone, so I didn't have any deadlines. So I've recorded like 15 songs sometime, listen to them, scratch them all, go in again and do 10 and scratch them all. However, in the last 6 months, I've found what I think I'd like to come out with.
And so, what is it?
Oh, I was helped by Jeff Cook, who's a gentleman that's living here in New York. He comes down to New Orleans from time to time and have me to do recordings exactly the way we did them before, like early Lee Dawson songs like Hello Mama and things like that. And he wants them done today exactly the way they were. And I hire musicians and write the arrangements over again. And I couldn't get over how much fun we had, just loads of fun. So I have gone back, so to speak, rather than these newfangled gadget mind that you put on sometimes. I've gone back to just have a good time, and some of the new songs that I've written for myself are based on just having a great time in a studio. Fun, actually.
You know, you strike me in a way as someone who's probably a pretty introverted guy. I don't know if that's true. When it's carnival time, are you out there in the parade?
Not anymore. as a kid, I used to go out a lot, and even older, but not much. However, this year I recorded my first Mardi Gras album. First Mardi Gras album. In fact, they're doing a final production work on it presently in the studio in New Orleans. First time in all of these years that I've ever did a Mardi Gras album when I don't participate anymore.
You wrote the tune Whipped Cream, and
yes,
then Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass recorded it, and then it became used as a theme for the dating game. When you first heard it on TV, and I'm assuming that you did hear it when it was the theme for the dating game, what
yes
did you think?
I thought it was delightful. I thought it was great. It was, I felt really good about it. In a different way than hearing your song on the radio, because you would certainly hope your songs would wind up on the radio. But by that time, I had many, many songs on the air. And also, I had been in business long enough to know that just because you hear your song on the air doesn't mean that money's going to come rolling in. But to hear it on television as a theme song and to know that you could look forward to it next week, things like that, was really exciting, I must say, for a short while. It was only on for a while, of course, back there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Alan Toussaint is now working on an album of Mardi Gras music, and he plans to take a musical he wrote, Stagger Lee, on the road this year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Alan Toussaint's own recording of his song Whipped Cream, which later became the theme of the dating game.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, feminist psychotherapist Susie Orbach and Louise Eichenbaum raise a subject that they think women are too uncomfortable to deal with, the feelings of competition and jealousy between women friends. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new recording by flutist Fenwick Smith and the Boston Chamber Music Society. And urban legends expert Jan-Harald Brunvand debunks another story that circulates this time of year, the one about the poisonous poinsettia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. More than 1 million people in Ohio are said to be threatened with water shortages because of a huge oil slick polluting the Monongahela and Ohio rivers. In the Pittsburgh area, about 23,000 people remain without running water 3 days after thousands of gallons of diesel fuel spilled from a ruptured storage tank. Veronica Varga of Pennsylvania's Emergency Management Agency says crews are getting a handle on shipping water to the hardest-hit Pittsburgh suburbs.
For the most part, the water situation is stabilized. The conservation efforts have really enhanced the maintenance of water in the system, and efforts are being made to provide some interconnects, which will add to the water supply available.
An 80-mile oil slick is now moving down the Ohio River. Al Frank speaks for Ohio's Office of Environmental Protection.
Two areas have been affected, and that's the East Liverpool area and the Toronto area. Both are along the Ohio River, 30, 40 miles south of Pittsburgh.
Frank says a precautionary state of emergency is in effect for riverside communities as far south as Cincinnati. A cold wave that's blamed for at least 5 deaths has moved into its 3rd day. Temperatures dropped below zero in at least 17 states from the plains to New England. It was 37 below in Embarrass, Minnesota, and 27 below in Bismarck, North Dakota. Scattered storms dropped up to 6 inches of snow in Oklahoma and nearly a foot and a half near Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. The State Department is defending the U.S. vote against Israel in the U.N. Security Council yesterday. Israel has strongly criticized the vote, which urged against deportation of Palestinian activists from Israeli-occupied territories. State Department spokesman Charles Redman today downplayed the impact of the U.S. vote.
I would see this as one more element in a situation which has been unfolding for nearly a month now. On this particular question of deportations, we have continued to state our position. It hasn't changed. What happened yesterday was a UN resolution, which came forward because of a particular set of circumstances. And as a consequence, in expressing that same position of principle, we voted for it.
Redman insisted that U.S.-Israeli ties remain strong despite the current policy disagreement. In the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip, Israeli troops clashed again today with Palestinian protesters. A West German court responded sharply today to threats of terrorists trying to influence the outcome of the trial of Abbas Hamadi. Today was the 2nd day of the trial. Hamadi is charged with kidnapping, transporting explosives, and intimidation of the West German government. From Dusseldorf, Deidre Berger reports.
The presiding judge at the trial of Abbas Hamadi condemned a threat sent to the West German government by the kidnappers of a West German hostage in Lebanon. In a letter, the kidnapper said the fate of the West German hostage was linked to the outcome of the Dusseldorf trial. The judge and defending lawyer said the trial would not be influenced by such threats and emphasized that the West German government has no voice over the outcome of the trial. Abbas Hamadi himself declared that he had not been mishandled during his year in prison and again called for the release of the West German hostage in Lebanon he is accused of helping to kidnap. In testimony from friends, Hamadi emerged as a person with little or no political interests, but a childhood friend said at least 2 of Hamadi's brothers are involved in the pro-Iranian Hezbollah group, which is suspected of kidnapping 2 West Germans last January. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Dusseldorf.
Stock prices posted modest gains on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 6 points to 2037.8. Advances led declines 3-2 on volume of 169 million shares. I'm Sharon Green, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has the review of a new compact disc with flutist Fenwick Smith and the Boston Chamber Music Society performing the music of Aaron Copland and Arthur Foote. Like Copland, Foote was an American. He was born in 1853 and died in 1937. Copland is now 87, but no longer composes. Lloyd says the pair makes for an interesting study in theme and variations.
Fenwick Smith is the thinking person's flutist. He probably gets his fill of the standard repertoire as the Boston Symphony Orchestra's second flute. So when he's not playing in an orchestra, you're more likely to hear him play a new piece by Joyce McKeel or an arrangement of Schoenberg than a Mozart flute concerto or a transcription of Danny Boy. His latest recording, a new CD on Boston's enterprising Northeastern label, is a collection of short chamber pieces by Aaron Copland and Arthur Foote, most of them never recorded before. These two American composers, born half a century apart, make an interesting coupling. Both have a delicate ear for chamber music. Both make demands on their instruments, but the result is far more thoughtful and lyrical than virtuosic. Copland, of course, is practically synonymous with homegrown Americana, but he had to go to Paris first to study with Nadia Boulanger before he could rediscover or reinvent that American sound. And though he kept moving back and forth between his populism and a more abstract international style, you can still hear echoes of Billy the Kid or Appalachian Spring, even as late as the duo for flute and piano, composed in 1971. Unlike Copland, Foote never left America. He barely left Boston. At Harvard, a little over a century ago, he earned the first higher degree in music ever to be awarded in this country. But he has the urbane, post-Brahmsian, continental sound of turn-of-the-century musicians everywhere, especially in America. Depending on the piece, you could mistake him for Mendelssohn, or Elgar, or Fauré. Here's the opening of his deceptively simple Aubade Villageoise from 1893. Smith's pianist is Randall Hodgkinson. Copland pieces on this CD are his most recent chamber works, all written in the early 70s, including an arrangement for flute and piano of his Vocalise, a work he originally composed in 1928. This recording makes one regret that they aren't played more often. There's a melancholy dignity in this late blossoming of the more abstract kind of music Copland returned to after his big popular successes. It's a reminder of the compositional refinements he learned from Boulanger, and especially from her devotion to Stravinsky. The short First Threnody, for example, one of Copland's most moving works, was written in 1971 in memory of Stravinsky. One might guess it was looking inward, too, both back in time and ahead to his own end. Copland wrote only a few more pieces before he stopped composing altogether 10 years ago. Fenwick Smith is not just another brilliant flute player, but a wonderful musician. His long breath spans make beautiful, buoyant phrases, unaffected yet full of deep feeling. He also has excellent taste in his partners, the superb Boston Chamber Music Society, and guest harpist Katrina Yates, W.B. Yates's granddaughter, who now plays in the Cincinnati Symphony. Let's close with Smith, Yates, and cellist Ronald Thomas in Foote's Elegiac at Dusk.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Aaron Copland and Arthur Foote, Chamber Music with Flute, a compact disc on the Northeastern label. This is Fresh Air. My guests are feminist psychotherapists Susie Orbach and Louise Eichenbaum. They are best friends who have also been partners in establishing women's therapy centers. While working together, they found unexpected feelings of jealousy and competition creeping into their relationship. In their psychotherapy practice, they observed other women also facing new tensions in their friendships. Orbach and Eichenbaum have collaborated on a new book titled Between Women, Love, Envy, and Competition in Women's Friendships. It's about the crisis they think women are experiencing in their friendships with each other, a crisis that they think may be an ironic effect of feminism. Susie Orbach recalled what relationships between girlfriends were like at the beginning of the women's movement.
We hang out all the time together. There wasn't an activity that couldn't be cut into to do it with a girlfriend. Now, we have to squeeze it in around, I mean, because we're more in the workplace, because a lot of us have children, because of us have serious intimate sexual relationships, girlfriends often come second, third, fourth place in a way that they simply didn't 10 years ago.
You described something in the book that I know I could relate to, and a lot of people could, is you want to see your girlfriend, and you whip out your calendar, and you start looking at the days, and you can't find a day in the next month that you can both coordinate seeing each other, and it's a terrible, terrible feeling.
It's really terrible, and I think that women are feeling the loss of their women's friendships. I think that they're really missing one another, so that you realize that the ways in which we refuel our emotional supply system by talking with girlfriends and spending times with them, we're really feeling very depleted.
It's hard, it's unfortunate, but it doesn't make us feel bad as some of the other emotions that you get to in the book. For instance, the feeling of competition with a very good friend. And that's something that I think in the women's movement, women really try to transcend, overcome, to not feel competitive, but to feel a sense of sisterhood with other women. And you're talking about this feeling, these feelings of competition creeping back into relationships.
Well, I think we were very successful at banishing those feelings of competition because I don't think, for a lot of us, we were competing with one another for men. We were actually involved together in trying to get some recognition, to push forward on projects together, to create things together. But I think one of the ethoses of the women's liberation movement, which stood us in good stead at the time, was we all had to do everything together. God forbid anybody should do something a quarter of a centimeter ahead or do something slightly different. That was extremely threatening.
What are some of the typical ways you've been seeing this kind of competition come up between girlfriends?
Well, in sort of two arenas, largely, either at work, where there's it may be a coworker who also happens to be a friend, or is just another coworker, and also sort of on the home front. I mean, the ways in which women used to feel competitive before the women's movement, unfortunately, haven't completely died down. I mean, that is, women can still feel incredibly competitive with one another about how they appear, how they manage to put themselves together, the ways in which they're able to either have children now or, and still continue to work and so on. So there's sort of a larger scope of area now that women can feel competitive about.
I suppose what we're really trying to discuss in Between Women is to recognize these are terribly difficult feelings, but that instead of them being things we have to hide or feel ashamed of, to recognize that competition is a cover for a lot of very complicated feelings about women's invisibility, about recognition, about the desire to do what the other woman has, about one's coming to terms with areas that one does feel inadequate, because those are quite important, actually. There's nothing, we don't need to be ashamed of the areas in which we need to grow in.
You make the point that women friends are usually much better at supporting each other in times of adversity.
Absolutely.
Than sharing in the pleasure someone might experience at something good that happens to them.
Well, I think it's possible to share the pleasure if it's simultaneous. It's when there's a difference that's going on that I think the difficulty really creeps in. If two of you are promoted together, I don't think that's a problem. But I think if one of you has a situation of joy, then I think it can be very, very difficult.
I mean, that's part of what's so awful now, is that we do know how to commiserate. We do know how to support one another. We do know how to say, this situation is awful. My relationship is unsatisfying. I hate my boss. I hate my job.
I don't want to give that up, though. I need that support,
right,
too.
I don't think, I mean, that's terrifically, it's to be able to offload those kinds of feelings is wonderful. But to be able to tell a friend or to be able to share with a friend something that is very positive that's happening, very sadly, is difficult for women. It's hard to feel. I mean, of course, this isn't across the board, but sometimes it's very difficult to feel just a pure feeling of joy and pleasure for your friend when she's telling you about something that's really terrific that's happening for her. And very often it is accompanied by this sort of sickening twinge that you can feel viscerally, you know, in your body of envy.
Why do you think that is? Do you think that we want to see ourselves reflected exactly in the people who are closest to us?
I don't think we feel entitled to what it is we're now receiving, which we fought for. Deep inside of us, I think there's some nagging worry, some feelings of fraudulence, some insecurity, some feeling that we'll be in trouble for getting it. Somebody's going to take it away. Somebody's going to be cross with us. There is a real feeling that one is doing some act of betrayal, that one is somehow betraying unconsciously women.
You know, but of course that also has some, if you don't mind my saying, it does have some sort of roots that go back to earlier on in our lives. I think that feeling, that sense of betrayal, can very much be connected to the mother-daughter relationship, where even if one had a mother who very much wanted her daughter to have a life that looked different and a daughter who would develop in certain ways and be successful in ways that the mother wasn't, it's still very difficult for that daughter to feel that it's absolutely fine and a pleasure to have the things that she has now in her life if her mother didn't.
You're suggesting that women try to almost redefine their friendships and not try to meet each other in the sense of a merged relationship. We totally share everything. We totally share each other's feelings. We undergo the same experiences at the same time. But to kind of break away and then reform in the sense of we're both individuals. We have different kinds of lives. One has a family. One doesn't. One has a job. One doesn't. But we appreciate each other, and we can have this friendship based on what's different about us as well as it being similar about us.
Do we appreciate this relationship? I think something else that is very important to recognize is how much we need one another's support. And that, as we've said, women often feel that their own development is going to threaten that connection. And what we're trying to say is, no, if we're really going to be sisters, we have to be able to support each other's development, even in the differences.
You know what this reminds me of, in a way, is the kind of redefining of love relationships that women went through a few years ago, thinking, well, when I fall in love, it doesn't mean I will become that person. I will lead their life. Our lives will be totally intertwined every second of the day. We'll be to individuals who share a lot about each other's lives. But there was a real redefining and breaking away. And are you suggesting that women have to go through that kind of step within their relationships with each
other? See, there never was a symmetry in male-female relationships. In fact, the merger...
Well, it was unequal, yeah.
I mean, the merge, in a way, between women is much more complex, mm-hmm. right? Because one does identify, one does understand, one can imagine.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I mean, we have to recognize that, just to, you know, again, throw in a sort of tidbit here about how different this is today in the lives of women than it was. We were, the generation of women who are 30 to 40, for example, still, we're a generation of women who were raised to know themselves through their attachment to other people.
Not only are there a whole new parameters to the feelings, but we don't have mechanisms in women's friendships. If commiseration and support for the hard times has been our byword, or we all get out together and we all do it at the same time, then we don't have the mechanism for bringing up difficulties, for even having a fight, which you do in a sexual relationship. And I think it's so terrifying to disagree.
Now that you've isolated all these feelings that nobody really wants to admit to or to deal with...
Thank you very much.
do you make vows to yourself that when you feel envious of a friend, you'll admit it to yourself and admit it to them?
Well, I'll give you a good example. I mean, I remember when I was breastfeeding, Louise got off the plane and she looked absolutely gorgeous. And I thought... I felt that. And I thought, she looks so beautiful. And I had, you know, a flash of pleasure. And then I had a flash of self-hatred. And then I thought, hey, wait, you've got an analysis of envy. This must mean you want something that she has and you haven't been able to spring the time and the attention for yourself. Ask Louise to take you shopping.
And also, it's not that we absolutely say that women must speak up about these feelings every single time to one another. I don't think that's really... I mean, yes, speaking up is one part of what this is about. But more importantly, the first step is recognizing the feeling, and then rather than launching into some kind of self-hatred and battering of oneself, to be able to examine it a bit more, to be a little more self-accepting, to say that this is a feeling that's inevitable at this point in history for women, and to be able to sort of take a step back and think about what this is really telling you about yourself and what it is you're wanting, which might enable you at that moment not to hate yourself and hate the other woman.
Louise Eichenbaum and Susie Orbach are the authors of Between Women. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following?
Well, we're covering an unlikely coalition on Capitol Hill. Liberals and conservatives who agree about one thing, and that is more federal funds for child care. Cokie Roberts reports. Also, a story from Linda Wertheimer on the Democrats campaigning in Iowa, where she is this week. And also a story about something very interesting in the current issue of Crocodile, the Soviet humor magazine.
What's the article?
Well, the article is an extract from a book called In Search of Melancholy Baby by Vasily Aksionov, who lives here and was stripped of his citizenship several years ago. It's most remarkable that part of his book should appear there.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our urban legends expert, Jan Harald Brunvand, joins us with the truth about a seasonal botanical myth.
Christmas is over, but you may still have some poinsettia plants around the house, so it's time to debunk the old poinsettia myth again. This has become a kind of seasonal ritual for folklorists, gardening editors, and especially poinsettia growers. First, to give you the facts up front, those ever-popular, decorative, red or white Christmas plants are not deadly poisonous, not even particularly toxic. If your kids or cats nibble on the poinsettias, it will be far more dangerous for the plants than for the nibblers. I've debunked this story in the past, but people keep on sending me photocopied magazine articles and pages out of books describing the poinsettia as poisonous. These sources include warning phrases like, may be fatal, and has been responsible for deaths among children. Such comments keep the anti-poinsettia tradition alive season after season. The usual reference, if any, backing this claim is a 1919 monograph about poisonous plants in Hawaii that mentions the death of the son of an Army officer stationed there, which was at first thought to be caused by the child eating poinsettia leaves. The Christmas plant has suffered ever since from this bum rap. Maybe there's something about the image of the innocent child eating the beautiful holiday houseplant that keeps the story going. Or perhaps the myth is encouraged by the fact that the name poinsettia sounds a little like the word poison. Early this year, I received what many people believe to be proof of the danger of eating poinsettia plants. It was an Ann Landers column from last March in which she published a letter by a distraught woman who wrote that her wonderful cat Chow Chow, the household darling for 14 years, had died. The death supposedly resulted from the cat eating poinsettias that had been sitting around the house since Christmas time. Unfortunately, not everyone who read Ann Landers' column in March saw her retraction of it in May. She cited the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and extensive research done at Ohio State University, all stating that poinsettias are non-poisonous. The place to look up such things is in the American Medical Association Handbook of Poisonous and Injurious Plants, a standard reference for physicians. According to that reference, the poinsettia, quote, has been found to produce either no effect, orally or topically, or occasional cases of vomiting. But people keep right on asking about it being poisonous. The poinsettia is one of the most frequent species mentioned in inquiries concerning plant ingestions made to poison control centers. So I think I should continue debunking the myth of the poison poinsettia, even if mine and others' efforts so far have not convinced people that the Christmas plant is less than fatal. Lest there be any misunderstanding, I do not, repeat, not advocate eating poinsettia plants. After all, the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission designates poinsettia as, quote, a non-food substance which, if eaten, could cause some discomfort. But that's discomfort, not death. This is Jan-Harald Brunvand wishing you a happy and healthy new year.
Jan-Harald Brunvand is professor of English and folklore at the University of Utah. Write us at Fresh Air with urban legends you've heard, and we'll pass them on to him. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with Duane Eddy. In the late 50s, Eddy's guitar twang helped define the early sound of rock and roll. Eddy's back now with his first new album in a decade. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the new album from the DBs, a group long popular in England, which is now attracting an audience in the United States. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Raw, the new movie of comic Eddie Murphy in concert. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance today from Lisa Bruton and Janine Colgren-Miller. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.